Pop Spotting 211.
Monday, February 13th, 2012.
Well, frankly, I'm amazed. Miss Tetherell saw this redskin live to tell the tale. I mean, you rarely see hide nor hair.
Welcome to Pop Spotting. I'm Jen.
And I'm Ryan.
It's Movie Monday, and today we've got an unusual double feature. It's another entry in the Films We Miss series, but we're going a little bit more art house this
week.
That's
right. The films are Meek's Cutoff and Certified Copy. Now, both films made several top films of 2011 lists and even got a bit of Oscar buzz, but fans had to be content with ranking them on Oscar snubs countdowns instead.
We were still curious, as both films look very unusual and understated, and the furthest thing from blockbusters.
Right, so were they worth our time? Were they worth that film critic buzz? We wanted to find out, so let's start with Meek's Cutoff. Now, Meek's Cutoff premiered at the 2010 Venice Film Festival, actually, but it didn't see its U.S. release until April of last year, and then that was only in very few theaters.
It was directed by Kelly Reichardt. She's very highly regarded in the indie film circuit. Her films Old Joy, that came out in 2006, and Wendy and Lucy in 2008 are both based on the writings of writer Jonathan Raymond, and they're all set in Oregon.
So, you know, Meek's Cutoff makes sort of an unofficial Oregon trilogy for her films, but it is based on a true story, a historical incident in the 1800s. As settlers pushed west on the Oregon Trail, a group of settlers basically split from that main route and basically head out into the unknown, into the Oregon desert.
It stars Michelle Williams. She was in My Week with Marilyn this year and also was in Brokeback Mountain, Paul Dano from There Will Be Blood, and Bruce Greenwood, who is recently
right.
Dr. Emmett Cole on The River. He was also in I'm Not There and Capote.
It was really interesting to see Bruce Greenwood, and in this particular role, not too far off from where Bruce Greenwood might have ended up on The River. But in any case, now we finally checked out Meek's Cutoff, and how did you like it? Was it worthy of all the love that it got?
This movie is a meditation. It reminds me of a Terrence Malick film. Terrence Malick from The Thin Red Line and The Tree of Life last year. Malick loves dreamy, long shots of nature, not much dialogue, just meditations on nature. And this movie did get a lot of love from the critics. And I won't say I found it boring. Boring is a very strong word, but the visual style of this movie was really not enough to draw me in. And I felt like maybe that was all there was. I really didn't feel any kind of connection with the characters.
Well, if it was like a Malick film, it's probably a shorter Malick film for one thing. But I agree, very little dialogue. And, you know, I think you did use the word boring, though, as we're watching the film and getting into it. And I think that it does require you to focus on it. Yes, there's very little dialogue. It's about this journey. So there's a lot of trekking, a lot of walking, and definitely a lot of silence. And clearly, Kelly Reichardt is trying to put us in the mindset of these people out there, you know, completely isolated. You just hear the squeaks of the wagon wheel and the footsteps of the people and the animals. And they have a bird that they keep with them just chirping a little bit. And very sparse music, and not much happens on this journey. You know, they pause to pray, they wake up early to do the washing, to do the cooking. But on the other hand, I think that when you do finally, if you can reach that meditative state that maybe Reichardt is trying to get us into, you notice things that maybe you wouldn't elsewhere. You definitely notice, for example, a sound that was with them for most of this journey when it stops happening. You know, it's not remarked upon. You see a quick shot of something, but that's the only information that you get. But because you're so in tune with this quiet environment, you do notice the absence of sound as well.
I did notice the wagon wheel, and I liked the way it had a very mournful sound. It sounded like a cry. It's very squeaky, and it sounded almost like the emotions that these women must have had. And I think part of the problem that I had was there's lots of scenes of men in groups talking, and we're not privy to these conversations, and there's
right.
so much whispering and so much mumbling that it's hard to get engaged in dialogue that we can't really hear.
I hear you, and you know, we're turning the volume all the way up, and it becomes very clear that we're not supposed to hear what they're saying. We're just as curious as these women are about what the men are saying, these men in charge of this expedition, but we're just not going to get that information. And it's obvious that Kelly Reichardt is telling this story of survival and striking out into the unknown from the point of view of these women who just basically have to follow along with them. And she's clearly making the choice to frustrate us in that way. You know, the men have their conversations. We're not part of them. The women aren't part of them. And they can only stand off to the side and wonder what they're talking about. So we're pretty much isolated out in the Wild West. This is definitely not a special effects and action film. It's really about the people that we're following on this journey. And I guess it comes down really to the performances.
Yeah, the performances are great. Bruce Greenwood is unrecognizable as Stephen Meek. He looks like an insane person, and he might be insane. He's disheveled and he's rugged, but he presents himself as very wise and confident, and it's easy to see why somebody would follow him. He seems to have a cult of personality with these people.
Yeah, so they're making this journey, and they believe he knows a different way, another way to maybe avoid some dangers, maybe find some other opportunities. I mean, there's all sorts of questions about what the motivation are of the people who choose to follow him. But like you said, you can kind of see how they might have been sucked into the stories that he tells, although at very early on in the film, it's clear that they're pretty much not interested in hearing any stories. They just want to get to where they want to go. You know, the film is called Meek's Cutoff. It's about this man and basically the route that he charted on this expedition. But again, I think we're following, in Kelly Reichardt's point of view, the people who follow him, these three families, or actually these three couples, basically, one of which has a kid, and there are very few belongings. There are three wagons, a few animals, following Mr. Meek. And I agree that Bruce Greenwood is doing something really interesting here. He doesn't even look like the same guy, but I think that the focus, as Reichardt wants us to have it, is on the women that are following, basically walking behind these wagons the whole way.
I think Michelle Williams might be one of the best actresses working right now, and this movie is no exception. The film is very restrained and conservative. All the female characters in this film are very restrained, very conservative, very religious. So there is a point where Michelle Williams has to make some decisions for these people. She has to stand up to Meek, and she has to stand up for the families. So when she does eventually take action, it's in a very modest, kind of level-headed way. You can tell that she's a little bit angry, but she's still very measured, she's still trying to be very careful to not overstep her bounds. So this decision that she makes is very pivotal and very powerful.
Yeah, you know, I mean, it is kind of a feminist film, I think, because we do see things from the women's point of view. They're very deferent to their husbands. They don't talk back. I think that they have some conversations. You know, we do see Michelle Williams' character and her husband, Solomon, played by Will Patton, in private times. Once they're out walking together with nothing but a lantern in complete darkness. Another time, maybe they're in their tent and they're having a conversation, but it's nothing like conversations I would say modern couples have. And even when she does say something contrary to what he says, she apologizes profusely because she knows that that's not where she needs to be. So yeah, I mean, I don't think anybody raises their voice louder than not even a shout in this film. So if there is even a climax, if you could call it that in this film, it's all Michelle Williams, and it's her ability to convey that power and the intensity without raising her voice. I mean, she speaks very quietly even at that point. So I agree. Her performance is probably the strongest part of this film, probably the reason why you might seek it out, to see how much she's able to do, even though at least figuratively her hands are tied, given the environment, given this world that her character lives in.
We have another couple of female characters. Shirley Henderson plays Glory, who is a mom, and Zoe Kazan plays Millie. And Millie is the only character that strikes a really sour note with me, because at one point in the film, she becomes very hysterical. She becomes very frightened. And I thought her performance was over the top.
Well, she definitely has, I guess you're right, she kind of makes the most noise, and in the end is perhaps the only person who can't be restrained anymore, who has to express that fear and, you know, a realization of the danger of that they're in, the precarious situation that they're in. I kind of like that she was basically married to Thomas, who's Paul Dano's character, and Paul Dano had an almost similar kind of character in There Will Be Blood. And I think that when you kind of reach that heightened level of madness, or at least paranoia, I mean, I could feel it a little bit. I mean, I think that she offered some catharsis for the fear and frustration overall. I mean, how precarious that their situation was here out in the middle of nowhere.
The scenery is beautifully shot. It's very bleak. It takes place in the desert, so there's lots of rocks and lots of sand. But watching this film, I felt very claustrophobic, which I thought was strange, considering that we do see a lot of sweeping shots of the desert, but something about it seemed very isolated and very pent up.
Well, I guess I can see that, because it's only through the eyes of these, you know, this very small community, this very small group, that you can process where they are and what's going on. But I mean, you know, I like those far off shots that show how utterly isolated they are. I thought that this movie was kind of a Western, but this is pre-Western, before there are towns and, you know, before there's civilization to get to. And I did like that, you know, there is sort of this gradually building tension. Boring perhaps for sure, but it's not like they can pull out their Nintendo DS or play Angry Birds. It's basically survival for them, as boring as it is. And as they run low on supplies, as they run low on water, they have to lighten their load. And I kind of like the imagery of when they start throwing things off. You know, they throw out nice chairs, they throw out an old clock. I mean, these symbols of civilization. I mean, maybe the houses that they left behind, and now they're completely out of context. They're completely isolated and fighting for their survival in the wilderness.
They're fighting the elements, but they're also fighting the threat of Indian attack. There's an Indian spotted following them, and the choice becomes following Meek, who people slowly begin to doubt, or the Indian, who might be leading them into a trap.
Yeah, and I think that kind of becomes the central mystery toward the end of the film, perhaps a mystery that isn't even, you know, satisfactorily answered, but I thought a great sort of decision that they have to make. The Indian might know the area better. He certainly looked healthy and well-fed. Maybe he knows where water is, but on the other hand, he does represent the enemy. He represents the danger that they were trying to avoid in the first place. So is he going to be their savior out here, or is he going to be the person who leads them to their doom?
Or is he just crazy? Either way, the, right. The ending is completely ambiguous. Wreckert doesn't give us any indication of who we should trust at the end, and this is clearly deliberate.
Yeah, I think she wanted us to think about it a little bit and come to our own conclusions, although my immediate response was just to run to Wikipedia to see how it turned out for everybody. I mean, I like the exploration of trust and, again, relationships with these people and facing the elements out there. I did like sort of toward the end where there's this really significant reveal about the path that they're taking and what it means, but nobody comments on it again. Nobody even notices it, I think. It's just you as the viewer kind of suddenly get a very clear picture of just how bad things are. But I don't know. I mean, I'm glad I saw this movie, but I'm not sure I would watch it again.
I don't know. I might. I do definitely appreciate it for what it was, and I did like the cinematography, and I like the performances, but it's not necessarily something I feel compelled to watch again.
Yeah. Well, let's move on to the other film in our double feature called Certified Copy. Just like Meek's Cut Off, it only saw limited release in the U.S., and that was last March, although it also saw its premiere at a film festival the year before, and that was at Cannes. Who's in this film?
Juliette Binoche. She's well known for The English Patient and Chocolat, and the British opera singer William Schimmel. He had not ever previously been in a film. This was his debut.
And I thought a pretty solid one. I had no idea that he had no film acting background, but, you know, that's it for the roster. The film is really about the two of them, a man and a woman, and what they get up to. This is a French film set in Italy by Iranian director Abbas Kiarostami, so very international there. He's part of the Iranian New Wave movement. And what is the basic setup for Certified Copy?
Binoche plays an art dealer. We don't ever learn her name. She attends a lecture by a British writer named James Miller. He's an art writer, and his thesis is that you shouldn't worry about whether a work is authentic or not, and that copies of art can have value also.
Yeah, and it's a pretty simple setup. Like I said, basically the two spend the day together exploring Tuscany and talking the whole way. It is one long conversation pretty much, and we think at first that Miller, the author, and this lady, Binoche's character, just met, but we find out over the course of this trip that might not entirely be true.
The movie has a clear thesis. It's an examination of what is real and what is not. The author talks about in his book about artwork, and that a copy of an artwork is just as good as a real thing, and that kind of carries over into the relationship between the author and the lady. Do they have a real relationship, or are they making one up? And it reminds me for sure of Before Sunrise and Before Sunset,
because
it's the same basic structure. It's two people walking around a city, but instead of wondering what is going to happen between them, we wonder,
what is going on between them.
Or what's happened between them. Is there a past between them? But I certainly see the comparisons to the Before Sunrise and Before Sunset films, which we like quite a bit.
Yeah.
And apparently there's going to be a sequel. I'm not sure if I'm crazy about that. But in any case, you know, that's the main mystery in this film. And I think that's going to determine how much you like it, because you're very conscious of the fact that Kiarostami is up to something. You know, is he playing a game? Is he giving us clues? Is there going to be a big reveal? You're always trying to puzzle it apart and figure out what's happening. I mean, are these two role playing with each other? Is it some sort of kinky thing to revive an existing relationship? Are they doing therapy, or is one of them using the other for therapy to deal with a relationship? I mean, they are dropping definite clues in conversations all the way through, although things kind of reverse a few times, and so you really have no idea what's going on.
I think this movie will reward you by watching it more than once. There are so many small things that you can pick up on. There's a conversation between the lady and the restaurant owner who just assumes that they're married, and at one point they're speaking in Italian and you don't know what they're saying to each other.
Right.
There's one scene with her son when he's skeptical and he doesn't understand why they're at this lecture, and he doesn't know why she has this sudden interest in this author or what she's going to do, and none of these things add up to one definite conclusion.
Well, and actually that conversation I liked, because they keep using the pronoun him, but I don't think they're even necessarily speaking about him all the way through. Like, is it his dad? Is it an absent or an ex? So I do agree that there's a lot possibly happening, and Kiarostami is definitely, you know, moving the ground under our feet. And so you just kind of have to go with it. You kind of have to love it. And as a result, it's about the dialogue, because of this long conversation, and about the intonation and the things they say and how they say it. And really, it comes down to the performances of Juliette Binoche and William Schimmel, because you have to believe that whatever they're expressing is real, even though it contradicts itself all the way through the film. I like that they have this opportunity as actors to explore different sides of a single character. I mean, they almost shapeshift in their personalities from one scene to the next, or actually during a scene, it seems like their characters change.
They are the ones that are telling the story. There's so many close-ups on this couple's faces. They talk about artwork and the scenery, but it's all about them. So we're purposefully not shown the artwork or any of the scenery really straight on. Just we see a lot of things in reflections, like in the car window or in the background as they're walking away.
Yeah, and so again, that's where I think Kiarostami is playing with us. They have this intense conversation about a sculpture in a square, but the camera never cuts away to look at the sculpture. You just hear this extensive debate about it. They call in another couple to ask them questions about it, but we don't get to see it. We can only see it through how they describe it and how other people describe it. So it is a very interesting film. And I do like that both Binoche and Schimmel take a couple of really sharp turns in this film. It's not just a gradual conversation that reveals clues. There's something else happening. I mean, she suddenly gets petulant at one point and very needy or very angry. She goes into the bathroom and puts on makeup, almost like a little kid. It's like, okay, we're going to try this again. Mm-hmm. We're going to start over, and I'm going to be romantic and loving. And then meanwhile, of course, he has a transformation. He becomes just a total jerk, and he picks on a waiter and complains about the restaurant and the wine when maybe she's trying to be romantic, or is she trying to be romantic? And they talk about, you know, newlywed couples, and he's dismissive and says, well, of course they think everything's perfect because they haven't been married for 15 years. And it makes you question as a viewer, so wait, is that the expression? Is he saying that he and her have been married for 15 years? I mean, you keep asking yourself, what is going on? And these sharp turns definitely amp things up here and there.
I don't know if these two are into whatever it is they're doing together, because she's the one who is driving most of the action. He's seems reluctant at best through a lot of the movie. He doesn't want to have his picture taken by the other couple getting married. He doesn't want to stay late. And Mrs. Train, he doesn't seem to really have his heart in it. So I think that whatever is going on is mostly her idea.
Well, you know, I was picking up on that too. I mean, the reluctant, he resists being in this picture with this, you know, symbolic tree of love, because I guess he doesn't believe in that sort of thing. He's not a romantic. He's not sentimental. And he kind of pulls back quite a bit. So I think one of the theories that comes to mind pretty quickly is that he's helping her work through something, that this is a therapeutic exercise. It vaguely reminded me of the very short scene in Memento where he kind of sets up this thing just to have this brief memory of believing that his wife is still alive,
right,
just because it'll fool his brain for that second. And I kind of got that sense out of this movie here. But yeah, I mean, there's a lot going on. There's a lot of symbolism in this film. And I think, you know, Kiarostami's not being subtle about it. There's a lot of religious symbolism symbolism. She goes into a church and there's church bells and discussion about forgiving people and starting over in a religious context. They encounter other married couples very, you know, clearly trying to send a message of some kind. They encounter the newlywed couple that she's enchanted by, but he's just, you know, poo-pooing all the way through. And then they're just walking down the street. They see a very old married couple barely holding each other up, and they kind of smile, but in a bittersweet way, and you don't know what that is supposed to mean or what they're thinking when they're seeing it. So I would have to admit that this film confused me quite a bit. I think that my American brain is just looking for the sixth sense, usual suspect, you know, aha moment, and it didn't give it to me. But it turned out that still that exploration, that wandering around with these two people was still great. I mean, it's frustrating, but in a delicious way. And I have to say, I really did love Certified Copy.
I enjoyed it as well. I think I liked it more than I like Meek's Cutoff, just because it is so open to an interpretation on all levels, not just the ending, but everything that you've seen. You really don't know what it is, and you can maybe come up with something in your mind.
Yeah, I wouldn't, you know, directly compare the two. I mean, they're not trying to do the same things. Reichardt is giving us a snapshot of a time and place and a pretty straightforward story and experiences of these people, whereas I think Kiarostami is messing with us, but I enjoyed being messed with, and at least in the case of Certified Copy, we are still talking about it, so that's a good sign. So that was our take on Meek's Cutoff and Certified Copy. Definitely hits on the indie film festival circuit and, you know, well-regarded releases from last year. We'd definitely like to hear from anybody out there who's seen these two films and have thoughts on what it all meant, or if you are of the art house crowd, if there are any other gems that we should be checking out. We just want to hear what movies you love, so please get in touch.
You can email us at feedback@popspotting.net. You can leave a comment on the blog at popspotting.net, or best of all, you can leave a voicemail that we can share on Friday at 815-310-0808.
You can also post on our Facebook page at facebook.com/popspotting, and you can catch us on Twitter at twitter.com/popspotting.
Come back tomorrow for TV Tuesday, where we'll spend some time over on the FX network. We will talk about Justified and Archer.
Ah, thanks to Dan Pashman of The Sporkful for our theme song, and mahalo to you for listening.
For Pop Spotting, I'm Jen.
And I'm Ryan.
Aloha.
Aloha.